This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. Did you know that olive oil is at its peak of flavor and nutrition right after it's fresh pressed at harvest time? That's why my favorite olive oil is delivered to me direct from the latest harvest, thanks to the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. And now you can try a bottle yourself, normally $39, for just $1, with no obligation to buy anything else. Visit myfavoriteoliveoil.com. In my case, it truly is myfavoriteoliveoil.com. Myfavoriteoliveoil.com. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. We're talking about the metabolic approach to cancer. We're with Dr. Nasha Winters, who believes that the terrain, your body's terrain, very much influences your likelihood of getting cancer and also your likelihood of recovering from cancer. And that's what we're talking about, the ways to improve that terrain through natural approaches. And Dr. Winter, you know, Winters, you yourself are a cancer survivor. Well, tell us a little bit about how that went for you and how that inspired you to do this, you know, enter this field.
Well, I tell you, I've been kind of a natural caregiver, healer, interested in medicine and sciences since a young age. My mom will tell you I tried to take care of all the animals in the neighborhood, you know, squirrels that fell out of trees, birds that fell out of nests. So I always had this sort of desire to help and nourish and nurture. And just like we talked about some of the emotional trunk there at that point, I think a lot of that came from just, it was my own survival mechanism of a pretty tough time in my life to just be able to focus on helping care for others. And of course, then invariably over time, put myself last. So fast forward to the age of 19, I'm in pre-med, in undergrad, and I am sick, landing in the hospital, the ER, every other weekend, it seemed, for almost a year. And everyone just sort of, after a while, I just became a nuisance. They already had an idea about me when I'd show up in the ER. I think they thought I was drug seeking, although I kept telling them I can't take any of the drugs you kept trying to offer me. Just over and over, super sick, more and more fatigued, more and more digestive problems, you name it. Finally, lo and behold, I end up with a different doctor who happened to be a visiting ER doc at the time in my community. And I came in very, very sick one night, and he finally did, and at that time, an MRI, this is in 1991, and some blood work, and came back in white as a ghost as he basically fell apart. And of course, in my mind, I jumped in to help him through the process to tell me that I was terminal, that I had what they found was an abdomen full of ascites, which is a inflammatory angiogenic process filling up my abdomen with a lot of fluid, that I had lesions all over my pelvis, I had lesions on my liver, and I had a grapefruit-sized tumor on my right ovary. And that also corresponded with a CA-125 of over 10,000 at that time. And these were some tests that we know,
as you know, as physicians, we know what all that points to, which is a very dire diagnosis of ovarian cancer.
You got it. So I was I think part of it, just being so young, especially back in 1991, we weren't seeing women with cancer at that age with that aggressiveness. And so I appreciate that it was missed because we weren't seeing it then. And so that's where, you know, literally at that time, I was in end organ stage failure. My kidneys had shut down. My in fact, the MRI that he did to check this almost killed me on the spot.
Yeah. With contrast. Contrast being very harmful.
Yes, exactly. And then, I still 26 years later deal with that issue, actually. But my, you know, everything was shut down and they were afraid. They basically said, we can offer you palliative chemo only, but even that will likely speed up the process because your organs have failed. And so, you know, given no option, they said I'd be gone within a couple of months. They referred me into, you know, a palliative care team, an oncologist, to kind of discuss my options. And everyone was in agreement that saying goodbye was the best and only option for me. So luckily, I'm a bit stubborn. I'm a redhead, and I got angry. I got really angry, actually. And in Chinese medicine, anger is the concept of the will to become. And what it did for me is it put me into action. action. I'm also very intellectual, and so I wanted to understand why, and I wanted to study it. And I thought, well, if I'm going to go out, I want to know everything about this beast while I'm going. And being a pre-med student, I worked at the library at my college, I started reading everything. And Dr. Huffman, one of the first things I ran across in my reading was the early works of Dr. Otto Warburg. Mm-hmm. This is in 1991 that I'm in a library reading this information about mitochondrial metabolic processes and how they drive a cancer process. And it resonates with me. It resonates with me so much, in fact, that I start to absorb everything I can, which there wasn't much then. You have to remember, there was no internet, there was no Dr. Google, you know, it just didn't exist. So I was doing it the old fashioned way and seeking the information and starting to make some changes in my terrain, in my diet. And that, interestingly enough, is what took me off course to going to conventional school, into naturopathic school, because at the same time, and I love that you started the show with this, at the same time I was reading about Otto Warburg, I started reading about Beauchamp and Pasteur's ongoing discussions. And so something resonated with me down to, this is all within my entire body. It's not a thing. It's not a tumor. It's not a tumor cell. And the only way I'm going to get ahead of this beast is to address the whole organism. And that's led me on a now 26 plus year journey in myself. I'm still working on it. I will be probably forever. And all of my thousands and thousands of patients who have joined me on this ride.
Wow. So clearly it was touch and go for a while, but gradually your cancer symptoms receded, your CA-125 declined. Are you considered currently in remission?
Well, my last, golly, it's been almost 10 years since I've had my last scan, because the dye really is quite harmful in my body, both CT and MRIs. My body just can't tolerate it. So I've done thermographies and vaginal ultrasounds and a lot of blood work and tumor assays blood biopsies, things along those lines over the years to keep it in check. My circulating tumor cell score is 0. So that's always
good. That's great.
Thank you. And my last scan did still show lesions on my liver, peritoneal implants in the tumor, which was much shrunken on my right ovary. So Western medicine would still say I still am a stage 4 cancer patient, but my body is not cancering.
Right. Yeah. And you know, for a listening audience, I mean, that may suggest the lingering presence of cancer, but it may be that we have a situation here, and I've seen it in some patients, where physical remnants of the cancer may be visible on imaging, but it seems that the immune system has sort of come to terms with the cancer. In other words, kept the cancer at bay. The cancer is present. There's a bit of an ebb and flow, but the balance is towards cancer control. And
yes.
I think that is, you know, one of the ways to be thinking about cancer is not, you know, eradicate it, annihilate it, you know, using military metaphors, but trying to create a rebalance the body so that the body is able to cope with a cancer event and keep it at bay.
And I think that's a perfect segue into the last 4 branches on that tree, because these last 4 branches I'm going to mention happen to be the areas that were most disorganized or chaotic within my own body at the time of my diagnosis. I already alluded to the mental emotional piece. There was quite a bit of trauma, but I was already kind of stepping into my power and getting out of some toxic situations at that time. So I felt like that was in motion. But inflammation, I mean, angiogenesis and inflammation, having a belly full of fluid, about 8.5 liters, by the way, which they had to slowly drain, because if they did it all at once, that also would have killed me because of the fluid balance in my chemistry. So we kind of just squeezed it out little by little over time. And at what drives
sounds like
that,
tapping a maple tree.
Yeah, you know, it's very slowly.
Yeah,
exactly. It kind of looked like maple syrup too, which is kind of gross. That's a little too much for your audience. But just to know that there was a lot of just muckiness. So when I think about that, I think there was a lot of sort of just toxic residue in there. And that process of ascites, that fluid buildup, is actually an inflammation process and an angiogenesis. And these are two other branches that we address on the tree, in that stress will stimulate angiogenesis, sugar will stimulate angiogenesis, inflammation will stimulate angiogenesis. And by that, I mean building of new blood vessels to a tumor. So on my last few scans, what we saw happening is all of the blood vasculature that was heading to that tumor on my ovary and other places in my body had stopped, it dried up. So you had these sort of like little islands walled off that looked necrotic in the center and pretty calcified on the edges, that just sort of, you know, nothing was feeding them anymore. So they didn't go get removed from my body or go away, but they're protected. You know, they're like away and I'm protected from them and they're part of me. So the other thing I focused on was hormone balance, because I'd had years and years. I started menstruating at 9 years old, again, rare. Yeah. Really young, and that would have been in the 80s. PCOS, endometriosis, these are two conditions we now understand as autoimmune disease. And they're also two conditions that we see are precursors to ovarian cancer. Flash that forward 20 some years to get that information. I also learned in the 90s that I was BRCA positive. So that to understand the etiology of some of this as well, which is simply a matter of my body didn't know how to take
the so-called Angelina Jolie gene.
Exactly. And my body, that's just a methylation problem. That's my body saying I need a lot more kale to keep things on track. You know, that was kind of the essence of it. And then the final thing is, in the time of my diagnosis, I had been working graveyard shifts for a long period of time to put myself through college. And so the stress of just taking a huge pre-med science load along with working graveyard shifts was another piece. And
it's circadian stress. It screws up your melatonin. It screws up your vitamin D. It's not good.
Everything. And even this year's Nobel Science Prize went to scientists around their work on the circadian rhythm. So these are the branches that I started to work on one by one, plucking a leaf here and there over many, many years. And of course, it picked up momentum as the science caught up with what I was seeing, and having hundreds, if not thousands, of patients and their labs and their stories and their experiences helped me start to create an ability to see these patterns very clearly and know how to address them very efficiently and effectively.
Well, your story is very inspiring, and you know, I hope that it gives hope and confidence and solace to many of our listeners who are confronting scary cancer scenarios. I mean, you survived one of the scariest, and that was many years ago. So that's really great information. You don't just talk the talk theoretically, you're walking the walk literally. So, you know, coming back to factors related to cancer, one that you mentioned in the book is sticky blood. Sticky blood is a factor in cancer. What's up with that?
So, you know, it's just like when you think about a pond, if there's not fresh water flowing through it, it starts to get stagnated and kind of thick. If you put your hands in it, you kind of feel greasiness to that. That in our blood is an issue with fibrinogen or fibrin, and this ability to make sort of clots and make all these little sort of mesh cobwebs throughout our system so that our blood flow doesn't move with ease throughout the vessels. And what happens if you're not moving through ease, it's like you start to clump up in certain places. In fact, many a times with that thick and sticky blood process, sometimes our very first indicator, in fact, a lot of times our very first indicator that there is a cancerous process happening is a blood clot. DVT, a deep vein thrombosis, is often the first sign of cancer. And so that is one of those places that we really look at how viscous is the blood. And that is how we can address it with, you know, looking at it with labs. You can even see some epigenetic tendencies towards making clots. And then also making sure that things like your liver is where a lot of the clotting cascades are moving through. So you want to make sure the liver is happy, and you want to basically be thinning that blood with good hydration, high quality omega-3s in your diet, good quality fats, exercise, saunas, you know, hot, cold to really stimulate your lymphatics and your circulation. Those are the types of things to keep your blood flowing.
You're a big proponent of mistletoe therapy. And for most people, mistletoe has the connotation of the place you stand in the party so that you can kiss somebody. But there's more to it There's more to the mistletoe story, and it's actually a therapy that's been around for a long time. You find it useful in cancer patients?
Oh my gosh, it's probably the most studied integrative cancer therapy on the planet. We just, in December, it'll be 100 years since this plant medicine has been used as an injectable, mind you, for cancer. So it has that history. And interesting on the sort of mythology, if you will, around this plant where we kiss under it at Christmas time, it was handed down from ancient, like the Druids and whatnot, that this was, you'd give someone a sprig of mistletoe and it was like giving them the kiss of life. And so the interesting thing about this plant is it grows out of sync and out of season. So it flowers in the dead of winter, which we can sometimes call that the dead season, you know, the dormant season. And so here's something that fruits and gives life in the middle of the winter. So I think there's something kind of interesting and esoteric about
that. It might be that plant has some special mojo that enables it to survive under adverse conditions, which is always a signature of some powerful medicinal effects.
It is. And those medicinal effects are lectins and viscotoxins. And these two components are the main constituents of this plant that have a very specific anti-cancer by doing things like immunomodulation, lowering angiogenesis, lowering inflammation, stabilizing our hypothalamic pituitary axis. We now think that it may be upregulating our endocannabinoid and our endorphin system. It definitely has some other, it definitely helps with the thick, viscous blood. And in fact, it's been a long-term remedy from Hippocrates' time for spleen, disorders of the spleen. And for those in a conventional medical place, that's where our cells, our blood cells are made. And when you think about cancer, especially cancer treatment, our blood cells really take a beating, our red and white blood cells. And mistletoe can really step in and protect the bone marrow and those cells while undergoing conventional therapy. It doesn't interact with the enzyme pathways of the liver, so it's safe to take with all therapies, conventional or otherwise. And it's been used, like I said, for 100 years. And if you live in Europe, you have, depending on which part of Europe, between a 65 and 85% chance of using this therapy somewhere along the lines of your diagnosis.
Mm, fascinating. Yeah. It's just there's such a gulf that separates us, because here it's esoteric. It's almost considered sort of a renegade therapy. What other supplements do you favor? What are among your favorites?
Well, I'm definitely a huge fan of vitamin D. We've really gotten out of the habit of letting our skin be exposed to the sun. We've gotten very sun phobic over the last few decades, when in fact, most of our issues of vitamin D is that today we use things like detergents on our skin, which wash away our ability to absorb our vitamin D. It takes 3 days for the vitamin D to synthesize through our skin. So I always tell my patients to not use soap, except for on pits and parts, because you want to make sure that vitamin D is doing its job and getting into the cells. We've also been on such a low fat kick over these last years. This is a fat soluble vitamin, and it's better absorbed with good fat. And it needs its buddy, its partner in crime, vitamin K, which has frankly been found in our grass fed meat and fat products. So like lard, we've gotten away from lard, right? No bucket under the kitchen sink filled with bacon drippings. And those are our vital levels of vitamin K. So taking those in can really upregulate the immune system. And vitamin D itself has an on-off switch on hundreds of different epigenetic switches within our body. So it's huge. It's also it's basically a hormone. It's very hormone modulating, immune modulating, balancing to the immune system, balancing to the blood sugar system, as well as our sex hormone and thyroid hormone system. So it's a big one. I always check on that, and we're far too low these days. We still say that it's normal to be at 30, yet our blood from World War I and II soldiers that we have banked that we can still do tests on show that the average level at that time, at the early 1900s, was 115 millimolars, you know. So that was a big difference, where today we say, oh, you're fine at 30 to 50. And I push my patients to get closer to 80 to 100, especially in the cold and flu season, which is when we have the least amount of vitamin D available to us from good old sunshine.
So that's one of the important ones. Are you a big fan of some of the mushroom extracts, immune-supportive polysaccharides?
Absolutely. There's so many cool ones. We can even get very specific. Like, for instance, shaga mushrooms are very beneficial in the melanoma patient. Reishi in a lot of ovarian patients. Same with agaricus in ovarian patients. So there's even sort of like fingerprints to certain cancer types with many of the mushrooms out there. And just like in natural time when we foraged for mushrooms in nature, we didn't just sit there and eat pounds and pounds and pounds of reishi. We mixed it up, whatever was available. So I do have my patients cycle through them, you know, just like probiotics. We weren't eating or ingesting the same ones. So I make sure we cycle through what even probiotics we're exposing our body to. But yeah, I think they're a very powerful, underappreciated medicine.
Things like EGCG, curcumin, sulforaphane, these are part of your repertoire against cancer?
They sure are, but man, they're all food derivatives. And so I like to get the whole plant. So sulforaphane's coming from your cruciferous brassica family, your cauliflowers, broccolis, cabbages, bok choy. So I want to make sure folks are eating that. It's even far more potent to eat a few tablespoons of your own sprouted broccoli sprouts than it is to take a DIM or indole-3-carbinol or sulforaphane supplement. Same thing with curcumin. In India, you can average up to a quarter cup a day of turmeric. And yet it's something we don't have much for in our palate as Americans outside of our good old golden mustard. That color is given to us by turmeric. That's probably the only place where we get it in our diet here. So adding it liberally to everything you eat and even drink, it's lovely added to teas and coffees, things like that. It's pretty benign taste and blends with whatever you're feeding it. And then things like resveratrols, those come from like our dark skinned berries and even the skins around pistachios and, you know, things like that, that I try to get these potent extracts in a whole food form.
So, that's sort of a comprehensive approach to cancer, such as you might find in this book, which is The Metabolic Approach to Cancer, Integrating Deep Nutrition, the Ketogenic Diet, and Non-Toxic Bio-Individualized Therapies. Dr. Winters, how do people get in touch with you? Where is your practice located? You're in Colorado?
I live in Colorado, but I practice virtually. I actually do consulting now. I sold my brick and mortar practice a few years ago. So now I take that bird's eye view with folks. I help patients, doctors, and researchers from around the world take that, you know, we test, assess, and address, and then I give them a very comprehensive roadmap and explanation of what I'm seeing and what could be the best to bring them back into optimal health. And so I try to align them with like-minded providers from all over the country and like-minded therapies that fit their particular patterns and help them get started, because boy, when you are diagnosed and you get online, you are overwhelmed. Probably in some ways, me being diagnosed in 1991 was my biggest gift, because I didn't have to have so many opinions and ideas thrown at me to choose from. But after 26 years of being on this journey for myself and helping thousands of others do the same, I've been able to really see what works and doesn't work in a very thoughtful, but even logical and testable situation. Yeah.
So patients with a cancer diagnosis, perhaps they've seen an oncologist, perhaps they've even seen integrative doctors, they're overwhelmed with some of the options that might be available to them. They can present their records to you and consult with you virtually, and you can help sort among the options and point them in the most beneficial direction.
You got it. And I do that with a lot of doctors as well, who are now, of course, starting to see more and more cancer patients in practice, whether they wanted to or not. It's just the nature of the beast today. So I help doctors do the same, help them to start thinking terrain-centrically and not tumor-centrically on how best to support their patients. So folks can find me on optimalterrainconsulting.com. I also have Optimal Terrain Consulting Facebook page. Jess and I have our Metabolic Approach to Cancer Facebook page. Of course, the book is a huge primer for folks who are waiting to see me. We usually have them read it because it doesn't seem quite as foreign when we have our discussions together. And it's a great guide for people. We have a questionnaire at the beginning so people can get a sense of what their priorities are, where to start, and how to really educate themselves and support themselves to the best of their abilities.
Well, Dr. Winter, you're truly an inspirational healer and a beacon to people with very, very challenging diagnoses of cancer, because your personal story, your knowledge, I think, really makes for a very, very credible approach, combining, you know, all the modalities that are available to us. I think that's the way to go when we're dealing with as complex a disease as cancer. There's no one-size-fits-all approach, and there probably never will be a, quote, cure for cancer, one single medication that's going to vanquish all cancers.
Correct. Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for joining us.
I thank you. This was an incredible discussion. I appreciate the opportunity.
It's my pleasure. The Metabolic Approach to Cancer by Dr. Nasha Winters. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.